Good evening. The indictment of 24 top-ranking Nazis was seen by the nation's editors and radio commentators over the weekend as setting a world historic precedent, the precedent of calling to account before an international tribunal those individuals responsible for acts of aggression and brutality against humanity. The Philadelphia Inquirer said, "It marks the beginning of a new concept of international justice and the first attempt to restrain the war makers of the future by the solemn warning that they, like those who did Hitler's bidding, will be held accountable for their acts. It sets a precedent for the trial of Japan's warlords, who also conspired against humanity." The indictment deserves to be read and studied by free men everywhere. It's phrased in cold, impersonal, legal language, and it makes clear the many ramifications of the sinister master plan by which the Nazis sought world domination. It recites for history to remember the long list of brutalities and atrocities which blacken the record of this generation. Lisa Sergio on the American Broadcasting Company stated that the trial of the 24 top Nazi war criminals must not only establish the undeniable guilt of these men, but it must also bring out the pattern used by them to bring about the conditions under which they were able to commit their crimes. If we do not manage to do that, the moral gesture of the trial will be lost. High praise must go to Justice Jackson, according to Miss Sergio, who fought for the view that top military leaders are just as guilty as the men in the government. We must take care that the less prominent members of the Nazi Party, and especially the economic supporters of the Nazis, do not get away. These men are just as responsible for Hitler's rise to power as are Goering and Ribbentrop. The New York Times points an accusing finger at the indicted individuals. The Nazi conspirators, says the Times, if they may be so regarded, divided their labors according to their tastes and their abilities. Hans Frank was a butcher in occupied Poland. Wilhelm Frick in Czechoslovakia. Schacht, Papen, and Krupp condoned butchery, and they made it possible without directly engaging in it themselves. Keitel, Jodl, Raeder, and Donitz conducted war in more or less the usual German manner, but they protected Hitler's murder gangs, and they did their best to win new land and power for them. A military or naval officer or a civil servant may plead that he obeyed orders, but the blood and the tears of the millions of dead will still cry out against him. The Columbus, Ohio Dispatch emphasized that the trials do not conform in one sense to the idea of a conventional trial by jury in this country. The defendants here are not presumed to be innocent until they're proved guilty. They are assumed to be guilty before being brought to trial, and the procedure is one merely in which the guilt will be recorded before the worst offenders are shot and the lesser ones exiled, imprisoned, or punished in some other way for their participation in the crime. It has been a contention of many throughout the centuries that there must be some way by which war can be controlled by law. And this is the first time in modern history, and perhaps in all of history, that the idea is actually being tried out. Eureka Mann, in the current issue of Liberty magazine, points out that while the figure of only 24 may be low, each case involves more than the individual defendant. Along with the accused, maintains Miss Mann, the Army, the National Socialist Party, or the government organization of which he was a prominent member also goes to trial. Once an organization has been branded as criminal, all its voluntary members are pronounced guilty. Thus, the 24 cases tried before the tribunal may result in the conviction and the punishment of millions of others. Ned Kalmer on CBS observes that the unity achieved in Berlin and the indictment of Nazism emphasizes also the disagreement existing in all other fields. Russian and Anglo-American statesmen are deadlocked on the future of the Balkans. America and Russia disagree on Japan, and America and England are still divided over the issue of Palestine. We agreed on the treatment of our enemies, but we cannot agree on the treatment of our own allies. This is in sad contrast to the unity in Berlin. The San Francisco Chronicle feels that the trial set a precedent for all times, and that it is an evolutionary extension of international law. The process now underway in Berlin, says the Chronicle, is the original one by which human society established laws to punish criminals. The first laws against murder and theft and the like were not enacted by legislatures. They were produced, democratically enough, but informally, by groups of people to fit a recognized social need. And they were custom in the forest, on the plains, and in the jungles long before they were formally defined. This is what the World Group is now doing in Berlin, emphasizes the Chronicle. They're trying to fit a social need, now recognized clearly for the first time. And it is establishing a world law of world responsibility of conspirators against the security of peoples of the globe. It only fulfills the maxim of the law that where there is wrong, there is a remedy. While an international tribunal seeks to mete out justice to those war criminals who tried to harness the world to a German yoke on the other side of the world, over in the Far East, restless nationals in the Dutch East Indies and in French Indochina are making a serious bid for independence. The nation's editors and commentators are pointing out that the native revolt in Java has important international implications. The Chicago Daily News warns that the Dutch East Indies may become another Balkans. The Denver Post says that whatever happens, the United States should keep their hands off. The Richmond Times-Dispatch recommends that a Big Five commission be set up right now to settle the dispute. Briefly, here is what has taken place. In 1942, a prostrated Holland, to counteract Jap propaganda, promised dominion status to the Indonesians, as the residents of the Dutch East Indies are called. The move was forestalled by the invasion of the Japs. Now, with the islands again free from the Japs, the natives, under the leadership of Dr. Sukarno, are demanding complete independence from the Dutch. The Dutch claim that during the war, Dr. Sukarno collaborated with the Japs. The British occupation troops in Java, meanwhile, are having their hands full with open riots and bloodshed. And the fact that the British are using the remnants of the Jap troops on the island in an attempt to keep order has not helped matters any. The nationalists supposedly represent only 5% of the 42 million Javanese, but they have virtual control of the island, with the exception of the capital city of Batavia. The Indonesian drive for independence may well touch off explosions all over Asia. There have been riots during the past few weeks in Indochina against the French. It's merely a matter of time before India renews her demands for independence from British rule. Well, for the most part, the United States editorialists and radio commentators who are eyeing the situation in the Far East feel that these developments are the beginning of the end of the colonial system. As John B. Kennedy on the American Broadcasting Company expressed it, the white man's burden in the Orient is rapidly drawing to a close. Hardly has the war ended than riots and upriots are flaring up in India, Indonesia, and Indochina. The people are fighting for their independence. The great principles in the name of which we waged this war are on the side of the natives. Similarly, the Hartford Times writes that in principle, the United States is in sympathy with that aspiration for independence. By just such armed revolt, we gained our freedom from British domination. The Javanese revolt has vast possibilities. The clash between native aspiration for independence and imperial foreign domination involves deep human rights. The Portland Oregonian is convinced that the uprisings in the Far East are the sign that the colonial system is close to its end. It will linger where savage or barbaric peoples are the subjects, and under the polite name of trusteeship, where peoples are helpless to go it alone. But the domination of civilized peoples by others because they are stronger, we believe, is obsolete. It used to be possible, continues the Portland paper, to find degrees in the quality of colonial administration, and the Dutch administration of the East Indies in these latter days was justly pointed to as one of the best in the world. This is no longer to any point. General opinion now is that no colonial administration is or can be good if the people under it do not want to be ruled by it. The Cleveland Plain Dealer supports the Dutch charges against the insurgent faction in Java. The Cleveland paper points out that the Dutch have said that they're willing to sit down and discuss self-government with bona fide nationalist leaders, but they flatly refused to sit down at the council table with Dr. Sukarno and members of his regime, whom the Dutch say are quislings. The evidence seems to support the Dutch. Dr. Sukarno came to power as head of the puppet regime set up by the Japs. It was Dr. Sukarno who, as late as November 1944, ordered effigies of President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill burned in Batavia. The fact is, as conceded by neutral observers, Holland has given the Indies an excellent colonial administration for nearly a century. It has protected the natives from exploitation, improved sanitation, and it has raised the general level of education throughout the islands. There are a number of serious obstacles to be considered before granting the Indies independence and home rule. There are 150 ethnic groups in the island, which are united neither by a common language nor a common culture. The Dutch are prepared to offer the Indies self-government as soon as it's practical, which offers the only logical solution. The Baltimore Sun also makes the editorial accusation that Dr. Sukarno completely identified himself with the Japs during their occupation and, in consequence, is unacceptable as a representative of his people. Several observers commented on what role, if any, the United States should play in the Far Eastern power politics. The Detroit Free Press is concerned over the use of Jap troops by the British in Java to keep order. These troubles are a very intimate concern to us. They're bound to whet Russian suspicion that we might make Japan a vassal state for possible use later on in extending our sway in Eastern Asia. Maybe we should have a general inter-allied meeting to clear up the Far Eastern situation, which otherwise may become as tangled up as the Balkan trouble bag. John W. Vandercook on NBC reported, while no American policy has been drafted with respect to the independence movement of Indonesia, President Truman's message to Congress on Puerto Rico may be a hint to the Dutch. Our president has restated American belief in the right of self-determination of the so-called colonial empire. William Lang on Mutual recommends the American solution used in the Philippines be applied in the Far Eastern colonials. Unless some overall system of handling the colonial problems in the whole world is found, the big powers will have far more colonial revolts on their hands. The settlement of the question of Philippine independence has shown that the American method is by far the best. Why not apply that same method to Indonesia, India, Korea, and Indochina? The Indianapolis Times warns against United States intervention. The reason is clear, says the Times, why the British Labour government is backing the Dutch in the East Indies. But while understanding the British and the Dutch viewpoints, we do not wish the United States government involved. We naturally have interest in protecting lives of the innocent, but we want no American forces mixed up in any squabbles over the independence of subject peoples in colonial possessions. And that's Quoting America for tonight. If we haven't quoted your favorite editorialist or commentator, send us their opinions and we'll be glad to quote them too. And if there's some particular subject you'd like to know America's opinions on, tell us what it is and we'll be glad to gather various editorial and commentary opinions on that subject. Good night.